It's Friday, April 16th. Derek Chauvin's defense has rested its case. We start here. We could see a verdict in this historic trial as soon as next week.
What might have stuck out to me the most was how few witnesses the defense actually called.
What Derek Chauvin said when he finally spoke in the courtroom. Talk about a Russia reset.
I was clear with President Putin that we could have gone further.
President Biden with new tough sanctions on Russia. Will Russia now see the move as a provocation and respond? And tired of health measures here? Lockdowns in most of Europe still way worse.
It's been a struggle getting people vaccinated.
So why are the numbers going up? And why does the vaccine rollout there seem like a mess? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Mary Alice Parks. Good morning. Brad's off today. I'll be with you. Yesterday, another video released of another police-involved shooting.
Very difficult police body cam video was released late today.
Stop! Stop!
When the confusion is over, we learn the suspect is only 13 years old. His name is Adam Toledo.
The mayor of Chicago, emotional but also urging calm. The governor saying parents deserve neighborhoods that nurture their kids, and children deserve to be safe. Of course, this coming as we reach a pivotal point in the Derek Chauvin trial and the death of George Floyd. It's been on national TV all day, every day for more than 2 weeks. It's hard to remember a more closely watched trial.
Your Honor, at this time, the defense rests.
Thank you.
But now both sides have rested. That means no more evidence can be presented, no more witnesses. All that's left are the closing arguments to come. And it's hard to overstate the emotions, the anticipation around the idea of these jury deliberations. Many legal experts just a week ago talking about the powerful case the prosecution made. But of course, that was only one side. So let's get right to ABC's Whitney Lloyd, who's been coordinating all of our coverage and watching every minute of the trial. So Whitney, sum up the defense's argument. What stood out to you?
Well, you know, Mary Alice, I think what might have stuck out to me the most was how few witnesses the defense actually called. We saw the state call 38 witnesses over several days of testimony. But when it was the defense's turn, they only called 7 witnesses. Two of those witnesses were called to discuss a May 2019 incident in which Floyd was arrested. And the defense wanted to call those witnesses because they say that Floyd reacted in a similar manner on that day to being confronted by the cops as he did on Memorial Day of last year when he, of course, died after being restrained by former Officer Chauvin and the 3 other officers.
And when they came there, I tried to wake him up. They tried to wake him up. I tried to wake him up over and over.
They also called a woman by the name of Shawanda Hill. She was in the back seat of Floyd's SUV when the cops first approached.
He woke up the second time. I said, Floyd, the police is here. It's about the $20 bill. It wasn't real.
And she testified that he had fallen asleep while they were sitting in the car. And the defense has argued that that sleepiness is a sign of fentanyl intoxication.
Now, a few follow-up questions here, Officer Chang, for you.
They also called a police officer who was on the scene, who testified that he was worried about the other officer's safety.
Because of the crowd, so I just want to make sure that the officers were okay.
And that's been part of their argument all along, that Derek Chauvin was distracted from what was going on with George Floyd and the fact that he was losing consciousness because he was focused on the threat from the crowd. And then they had their experts. They had a man by the name of Barry Broad, who was the defense's use of force expert.
Now, so in terms of the initial uses of force, the officer's efforts to get Mr. Floyd into the car, you felt that they were objectively reasonable?
I did.
Did the use of force then continue after Mr. Floyd was restrained on the ground?
I don't consider a prone control as a use of force.
You know, at first he said that what he saw Chauvin do in the videotape that we've all seen didn't actually qualify as a use of force. But then under really quite masterful cross-examination by the prosecution, he really completely reversed himself and admitted that Chauvin's knee was, in fact, on Floyd's neck and that it actually would qualify as a use of force.
Wait, they got him to change his mind?
Well, prosecutor Steve Slisher really sort of boxed Barry Broad in with his own words.
Orienting yourself on top of a person on the pavement with both legs is unlikely to produce pain?
It could.
He played the body cam video that we've all seen played many times in court now, and stopped it at certain points and asked Broad, you know, very specific questions about where exactly Chauvin's knee was moment to moment to moment throughout that videotape.
Would you agree that what we're seeing here is a use of force?
Shown in this picture, that could be a use of force.
Okay.
You know, and then when defense attorney Eric Nelson got back up on redirect, he reversed himself again and said, no, it wouldn't be a use of force. So I think the defense's use of force expert really kind of crumbled under cross-examination on that one.
Mr. Floyd died of a cardiac arrhythmia due to hypertensive atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease during the restraint.
And then finally, defense had Dr. David Fowler testify. Fowler's a former chief medical examiner for the state of Maryland, and he testified that he believed that Floyd's heart conditions and drug use led to his death, which was in direct contradiction to what we saw the state's forensic pathologists say. They felt it was the law enforcement restraint that killed Floyd.
His face was facing towards the vehicle, towards the rear of the vehicle and directly towards the area where you would expect the tailpipe or tailpipes of a vehicle to be.
Fowler also suggested that carbon monoxide poisoning could have played a role because of the fact that Floyd was restrained near the tailpipe of the squad car.
Yeah, and then this back and forth about the state wanting to bring in new evidence related to carbon monoxide levels, but the judge not allowing it. Explain that to us. What happened there?
After Dr. Fowler brought up that carbon monoxide theory, the state wanted to admit what they called new evidence. And Judge Cahill said that they could not, that it was too late in the game, that they should have known that Dr. Fowler was going to bring up carbon monoxide. But they did allow the state to call a rebuttal witness.
Good morning, Dr. Tobin.
Mr. Blackwell.
Dr. Martin Tobin, who's a pulmonologist who had been an expert for the state. So he had already testified, but they recalled him to the stand. And he spoke about that carbon monoxide theory in a somewhat limited way.
And so the maximum amount of carbon monoxide would be 2%.
Essentially saying that Floyd's blood oxygen level was normal, and that would mean that his carbon monoxide level would also be normal, similar to what you or I might have in our bodies right now.
As to the statement that his carboxyhemoglobin could have increased by 10 to 18%, in your view, that's not possible.
It's simply wrong.
And thus, the carbon monoxide theory doesn't really make a lot of sense, according to Dr. Tobin.
Whitney, the defense rested, but Chauvin did not take the stand.
Yeah, that's right. There was, you know, a lot of people who were very curious if Derek Chauvin would take the stand in his own defense.
And have you made a decision today whether you intend to testify or whether you intend to invoke your Fifth Amendment privilege?
I will invoke my Fifth Amendment privilege today.
Ultimately, in court, he said he would invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege to not testify in this trial. His attorney asked him a series of questions to kind of establish that he was making this choice of his own volition. Judge Cahill did the same. But at the end, he chose to invoke that privilege, and he will not take the stand in his own defense.
Y'all see the difference? This is a taser. This is a taser. But no, my nephew was killed with this, a Glock.
Of course, we've all been talking about how Dante Wright died just miles away from where this trial is taking place. The jury in the George Floyd trial still isn't sequestered, right?
After Dante Wright was killed by police in a nearby suburb of Minneapolis on Sunday, defense attorney Eric Nelson actually asked Judge Cahill to sequester the jury because he was concerned that protests and news about another police-involved killing could prejudice the jury. And Judge Cahill actually said, no, he didn't think it was an appropriate time to sequester the jury. So the jury, you know, they have been going home each night. It is possible that they are aware of the news surrounding that case. It's possible that they have seen the protests, heard the protests. But both sides have been very clear that that's an entirely separate matter, that it really has no place in deciding this particular case.
Hey, members of the jury, the evidence is now complete for this case.
Next step for you is to listen to closing arguments and then retire for deliberations. That'll occur on Monday.
Closing arguments will be on Monday. The jury will be sequestered at that point, and then we wait.
What does justice mean for you in terms of the courtroom? What do you want to see happen?
I really just want to see the criminal justice system work the way that it's supposed to.
I think everybody is sort of, there's a feeling of everybody kind of holding their breath, right? The case is in the hands of these jurors now. So I think everyone is really just putting their trust in the jury to see what they made of what both sides were able to bring into evidence in the trial.
Whitney, we appreciate your insights. Thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
Next on Start Here, will President Putin actually meet with President Biden after what he just did? That's after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
President Biden yesterday wanted to make one thing very, very clear. He is not President Trump.
Now to the U.S. and Russia. And tonight, the Biden administration hitting Russia with sweeping sanctions after that massive cyber attack.
From the White House, the president slapping new sanctions on 32 Russian organizations and individuals, expelling 10 Russian diplomats from the Russian embassy in Washington. It's clear the president was trying to send a message. Let's bring in ABC senior White House correspondent Mary Bruce. Mary, let's talk about the timing. The president in his speech yesterday went back to the 2020 elections, said Russia needed to be held accountable for trying to interfere in those elections. But then he went on to say that these sanctions were about more than just that, too.
This was about a lot of different things. And I think part of that is because they felt that the previous administration hadn't taken strong enough actions, right? So the president here is trying to punish Russia, yes, for interfering in the 2020 presidential election.
Big concern this morning after a large-scale hack of U.S. government agencies by Russian spies. Our chief justice.
But also for hacking into multiple U.S. government agencies and major private companies like Microsoft.
Senator Mitt Romney called it the modern equivalent of Russian bombers flying undetected over our entire country.
That's the SolarWinds hack. And of course, he's also trying to respond to Russia's continued occupation of Crimea and reports that Russia offered bounties to militants in Afghanistan to kill American troops.
And we, of course, will not stand by and accept the targeting of our personnel by any elements, including a foreign state actor.
So these are sweeping sanctions and actions intended to penalize, you know, a wide range of actions by Russia.
So, Mary, sometimes these headlines about sanctions feel just kind of like a slap on the wrist, but it felt different. Do you feel like these are a big deal?
Well, these are certainly designed to have an impact, and it certainly is a jarring break from what we saw under the previous administration. Biden's team designed these sanctions to really hurt.
When we spoke again this week, I told them that we would shortly be responding in a measured and a proportionate way because we had concluded that they had interfered in the election and SolarWinds was totally out of the inappropriate.
The U.S. is imposing sanctions on 32 entities and individuals, also half a dozen cybersecurity firms, and they're expelling 10 Russian diplomats from Washington.
We cannot allow a foreign power to interfere in our democratic process with impunity.
We heard the president come out in these brief but blunt remarks at the White House and make very clear that he's going to take a stand, right, in defense of the U.S. and our institutions. But he also made it clear that he felt that this was a response in kind, because Biden is trying to walk this fine line.
I was clear with President Putin that we could have gone further, but I chose not to do so. I chose to be proportionate. The United States is not looking to kick off a cycle of escalation and conflict with Russia.
He wants what he called a stable and predictable relationship, but he also feels that these actions have to be punished. And that is why he took these sweeping actions.
Mary, you know, I was struck, too, by President Biden saying that he had a candid and, quote, respectful call with President Putin this week. You know, he seems to really think that there's room for the two countries to work together. I mean, is he going to be able to pull off some big Russia reset, or is that still just a pipe dream?
Well, he's trying to do two things here, right? To punish Russia while also trying to move forward with Russia. Those two things are kind of hard to do at one time.
I propose that we meet in person this summer in Europe for a summit to address a range of issues facing both of our countries.
And of course, President Biden invited President Putin to meet face to face this summer in Europe.
And out of that summit, where it occurs, and I believe it will, the United States and Russia could launch a strategic stability dialogue.
And of course, you know, I think it's important to remember how Russia has responded already.
Ответ на санкции будет неотвратимым.
We've seen the Russian Foreign Ministry call the U.S.'s actions here unacceptable. They're promising to retaliate. The president urging Putin to respond appropriately, but not to exceed it, because he says, you know, he doesn't want to ratchet up their relationship. And if Russia responds in a way that they think it is an escalation, well, then Biden warned the U.S. is ready to move as well.
It would be quite the summit, imagining those two leaders sitting face to face. Mary, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mary Alice.
The situation in our region is serious.
The European Regional Director at the World Health Organization had this sad announcement yesterday.
Last week, we surpassed 1 million confirmed COVID-19 deaths in the WHO European region.
Now, that region includes 53 countries, a population almost three times that of the U.S.
COVID-19 admissions to hospitals and intensive care in France reached the highest levels since this time last year.
ABC's Inés de la Quintera lives and reports in Paris and has been covering all the twists and turns of the vaccine rollout there. Inés, what is life like? What is it like there on the ground?
Yeah, so I mean, France very much still on lockdown. We still have, you know, all the bars and restaurants here are still closed. We're still under a 7 p.m. curfew. You're not allowed to go more than 10 kilometers from your home.
If we organize ourselves in the next few months, then we will see the end of the tunnel and we will find our way back.
France just became the third country in Western Europe to lose 100,000 people to COVID-19. The other countries being Italy and the UK. There's, of course, the UK variant that's spreading more rapidly in Europe. That's something we've heard the Germans talk about, how that they're pointing to that as part of the reason why there's this third wave in Europe.
The cabinet here in Berlin agreed to approve new national measures to try to bring down infection rates.
Our response to the pandemic must be more stringent and consequential.
And the other thing, of course, being the fact that restrictions were lifted too quickly. So in France in particular, coming out of the second wave, they did ease up restrictions, and that's being blamed for this surge in cases that we're seeing now. But vaccinations are slowly starting to pick up. I was just looking at numbers, and it seems France has by now at least 16.9% of the population have now received their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. So they are starting to ramp up their vaccine rollouts. But it's been a struggle getting people vaccinated.
You can hand it to the Americans. As early as summer 2020, they said, let's pull out all the stops and do it. And so they had more ambition than us.
The vaccine rollout just so much slower in Europe than in the United States. And now the pause in the Johnson & Johnson rollout, too. I mean, Europe was hoping to use that vaccine. It's just one shot. It was supposed to really help. How is the pause impacting Europe?
Right. So the Johnson & Johnson vaccine has been put on pause here in Europe, but we should point out it hadn't yet been put into people's arms. They hadn't started administering the shot. They were hoping, you know, they had just bought a ton of Johnson & Johnson doses. They were hoping that would help speed up vaccine rollout here because it is a single dose vaccine.
We have now more than 27 million Europeans fully vaccinated. And this is good news. But as we can see with the announcement by Johnson & Johnson yesterday, there are still many factors that can disrupt the planned delivery schedules of vaccines.
European regulators, so the European Medicines Agency, has launched an investigation into the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine and whether there could be a link there with these very rare cases of blood clots. They haven't ruled on that yet. So it is the company that decided, because it was pausing its rollout in the US, that it should pause its rollout in Europe as well.
Feels like Europe just can't catch a break. They're hoping to use the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That was going to help. It's only one shot. Now the conversation about that vaccine feels eerily similar to some of the conversation around the AstraZeneca vaccine about possible links to blood clots. After all that back and forth yesterday, Denmark saying flat out they're just not distributing the AstraZeneca vaccine anymore. Other countries this week pausing distribution too. But Inez, some countries in the EU are still giving out the AstraZeneca vaccine, right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of back and forth over the AstraZeneca shot. So we saw in the beginning, countries like France and Germany were concerned that it might not be effective in people that were older than 55, with the French president even saying at one point that the vaccine was quasi ineffective in the older population. So they had actually restricted use of the vaccine to people, to the younger populations. Then there were these issues with the blood clots.
He was starting to lose his vision, and a scan there revealed a huge blood clot and bleed in his brain.
You had a number of countries temporarily suspending use of the AstraZeneca vaccine while investigations were being conducted.
The reported cases of unusual blood clotting following vaccination with the AstraZeneca vaccine should be listed as possible side effects of the vaccine.
The European Medicines Agency, which is the body kind of overseeing vaccines in Europe, they finally released their results and said there was a link between these very rare cases of blood clots and the AstraZeneca vaccine, but they insist that the benefits of the vaccine far outweigh the risks. So they are encouraging countries to continue using it. France and Germany ultimately decided to continue administering the AstraZeneca vaccine, although they've now restricted it to people who are older than 55.
Yeah, I'd take anything, I think. As long as it's trusted, that's fine.
But interesting to note that other countries have seen this, and they have actually expressed interest in buying up doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine from Norway, from Denmark. So countries kind of, you know, doing their own thing here. It's a very much a piecemeal approach to how to handle this AstraZeneca vaccine.
Yeah, like you said, this, it seems like every country is just making their own decisions regardless of what the health leaders at the sort of overall EU level are saying. Inez, thank you so much for breaking it all down from Paris for us.
Thank you.
We're going to take one more quick break, but this state is willing to pay you to work from home from there. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Obviously, a lot of us are feeling rather pent up right now, still working from home. I mean, who is not craving more fresh air?
In West Virginia, we live and work just steps away from the landscape that inspires us.
Well, the state of West Virginia has quite the offer. The state and some nonprofit leaders will pay you $12,000 to relocate and work remotely from West Virginia. Country
roads. In a spirit of bringing people to this state because people so badly want to come.
The governor acknowledging that a lot of young people this last year have thought about moving away from big urban centers. They are rolling out the red carpet.
We have been the frogs that are now really truly proud of their own pond.
So if you're feeling those John Denver vibes, looking for some Appalachia in your life, this could be it. The offer is 10 grand for the first year, two more if you stay. Plus, they're throwing in co-working space, free recreational activities for a year so you can meet new people. Now, I will say that cell service in parts of the state is notoriously bad, but one picture on the website has people stand-up paddleboarding, which is all anyone needs to win me over. Start Here is produced by the wonderful David Ryan, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohen, Ariel Chester, Tara Gimble, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, Abe Velez, and Stacia Dushishku. Special thanks this week to Carlos Betcher, Gina Sinceri, Chris Berry, Catherine Falders, Leighton Schneider, and Luke Barr. I'm Mary Alice Parks. Don't worry, Brad's back Monday. I'll see you later.